Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivastati Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gaura Gopina Shyamakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaura Premanande All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vinata Swami Nityanamane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pracharane Nirvasesa Sunyavadi Paskatyade Satarane. Vandeham Sri Yuta Sri Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Bitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Bitamscha Panchakalpachubhishcha Kripasandavyavacha Patitanam Pavanevyo Vaishnavevi Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So it's March 6, 2024 in New Dwarka, Los Angeles, California, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 22, The Marriage of Kardama Muni and Devahuti. And this is again Swayambhu Manu talking to Kardama Muni. In text 6. Disya me Bhagavan Dristo
Disya me Bhagavan Dristo
Dvardarsho yo kritatmanam Disya pada rajas pristam Shirshna me bhavata shivam By good fortune, may my Bhagavan, all-powerful, Dristaha, is seen, Durdarshaha, not easily seen, Yaha, who, Akrita Atmanam, of those who have not controlled the mind and senses, Disya, by my good fortune, Padarajaha, the dust of the feet, Spristam, is touched, Shirshna, by the head, May, my, Vavataha, your, Shivam, causing all auspiciousness. What words repeated here twice? Fortune, good fortune. Distya. Srila Prabhupada's translation, it is my good fortune that I have been able to see you, for you cannot easily be seen by persons who have not subdued the mind or controlled the senses. I am all the more fortunate to have touched with my head the blessed dust of your feet. So I'm fortunate to do what? To touch my head to your feet, and first thing I'm fortunate to?
See you.
See you. So I'm fortunate to see you, and even more fortunate to touch my head to your feet. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The perfection of transcendental life can be achieved simply by touching the holy dust of the lotus feet of a holy man. In the Bhagavatam, it is said, Mahapada Rajo Bichekam, which means to be blessed by the holy feet of the lotus feet of a Mahat, a great devotee. Of course, Abhishekam literally means what?
Bathing.
As stated in Bhagavad Gita, Mahatmanas 2, those who are great souls are under the spell of spiritual energy, and their symptom is that they fully engage in Krishna consciousness for the service of the Lord. Therefore, they are called Mahat. Unless one is fortunate enough to have the dust of the lotus feet of a Mahatma on one's head, there is no possibility of perfection in spiritual life. So is that literal, figurative, or both? Both, yes. It's not that we always have to have some dust from Prabhupada's feet in a little container and everywhere we go we have to make sure we're carrying a few drops on our head, although that's also nice. The parampara system of the siddhic succession is very important as a means of spiritual success. So why is Prabhupada switching now to talking about parampara? One becomes a Mahat by the grace of his Mahat spiritual master. If one takes shelter of the lotus feet of a great soul, there is every possibility of one's also becoming a great soul. When Maharaj Rahugana asked Jeta Bharata about his wonderful achievement of spiritual success, he replied to the king that spiritual success is not possible simply by following the rituals of religion, or simply by converting oneself into a sannyasi, or offering sacrifices as recommended in the scriptures. These methods are undoubtedly helpful for spiritual realization, but the real effect is brought about by the grace of a Mahatma. In Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura's 8 stanzas of prayers to the spiritual master, it is clearly stated that simply by satisfying the spiritual master, one can achieve the supreme success in life, and in spite of executing all ritualistic performances, if one cannot satisfy the spiritual master, one has no access to spiritual perfection. Here the word akritatmanam is very significant. Atma means body, soul, or mind, and akritatma means the common man who cannot control the senses or the mind. Because the common man is unable to control the senses and the mind, it is his duty to seek the shelter of a great soul or a great devotee of the Lord and just try to please him. That will make his life perfect. A common man cannot rise to the topmost stage of spiritual perfection simply by following the rituals and religious principles. So Prabhupada's giving a second reason. First reason is it's not sufficient, and second reason is you're not going to be able to do it. He has to take shelter of a bona fide spiritual master and work under his direction faithfully and sincerely. Then he becomes perfect without a doubt. Disya me Bhagavan dristo sudarsho yo kritatmanam disya padarajas pristam srishna me Bhagavat Shivam. It is my good fortune that I have been able to see you, for you cannot easily be seen by persons who have not subdued the mind or controlled the senses. I am all the more fortunate to have touched with my head the blessed dust of your feet. Prabhupada says here, if one cannot satisfy the spiritual master, one has no access to spiritual perfection. Right? Yesterday, one of my old childhood friends took us behind the scenes at the Walt Disney Concert Hall, because he's the security, he's the head of security, right? He's the head of security there. So he had access, you understand? He had the access code. So we could go anywhere in the building because he had the access code. So I had some direct personal understanding of this principle when I was I had enrolled in graduate school. So I first enrolled, because I only had a bachelor's, so I enrolled in the master's program. And about 2 months into that program, I met with one of my professors who was at that time also in charge of the whole school of education, the whole college of education in the University of North Carolina. And I was going over with him. I said, I'd like to do this elective and so forth. And then he said, what are your goals? Why are you getting this degree? So I gave him my 8-point goals for creating a Krishna conscious school system in the world. And he looked at it and he said, you know, you should be in the doctoral program for educational leadership. And I said, well, okay. My original plan had been different. I wanted to get a doctorate in curriculum and instruction. And I said, but I have to finish my master's first, right? And he said, well, not necessarily. He said, maybe you can jump right to the PhD program. And I said, how do I do that? He said, I don't know. He said, just write up a letter. So I prayed on it, and I'm like, okay, Krishna, this is going to add at least a year to my studies, plus I'm going to have to write a doctoral dissertation. You know, do I really want to do this? And I'll try. So I wrote the letter, and I went to the secretary. I said, what do I do? He said, just give me the letter. And like 3 days later, there was a meeting of all the faculty of the College of Education. And because he was the head of the College of Education, he said, I'm recommending her. And the next thing I knew, I was in the doctoral program. And I could understand, you know, this, as soon as you please the person who's in charge, then you have all access. It was really quite interesting. I said, oh yeah, that's how it works. You know, you please the person who has access, and then you have access. You know, normally, you don't do a master's and doctorate simultaneously. Normally, you do them consecutively. Which, by the way, I don't advise anyone do them simultaneously. It was kind of intense. But I kept realizing this as I was going through the program. You know, at the end, I got both degrees simultaneously, and the college said, well, we have a policy that we don't grant 2 degrees simultaneously, even if you've earned them simultaneously. You have to be granted them consecutively. And again, I just went to the head of the School of Education, and I said, you know, would you fight for me? And he's like, sure. So I just saw, you know, the dean of the whole university, who I'd never met, I don't even know the person's name, they granted me this because my immediate authority granted me that. And I said, oh, you just please Guru, you get Krishna. That's just how it works. If I had tried to go to the head of the whole university directly, that would not have happened, for sure. And of course, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur talks about this in Madhurya Kadambini. In the very beginning, when he says, how does bhakti start? How does bhakti start to get awakened? This is a big question. I mean, at least when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, I was thinking, how is it that some people take up bhakti and others don't? And he says, Krishna is neutral. He's not going to interfere with the free will of the living entity. But the devotees don't have to be neutral. As Prabhupada writes in the Bhagavad Gita, the devotees of the Lord are more merciful than the Lord because they know the purpose of the Lord. So the devotees go out and they do Harinam everywhere without considering whether one is unfit or fit. They're giving the holy name to everyone. They're giving prasadam to everyone. They're giving the shastra to everyone. Imagine that. Something that just, I think is amazing. You know, that we were out in the airports and the parking lots giving out nectar of devotion to people. Krishna book. And we don't say, are you a vegetarian? Do you drink? Do you have 5 girlfriends? Oh, not for you. Right? We just give to everybody. And because the devotee is merciful, Krishna's mercy follows the mercy of the devotee. It's like the devotee creates a channel through which the mercy of Krishna flows. So here Srila Prabhupada says, and this is something that we really need to take seriously, that rituals and yajna are not going to be sufficient. He says they're certainly helpful, but they're not sufficient. And what we need to do is we need to take this abhishek in the dust of a pure devotee. And then Prabhupada concludes with saying, and you all become pure devotees too. You're all expected to become mahatmas. So why are these things insufficient if we want to attain perfection? I mean, we can think of the 4 main kinds of yoga, karma yoga, gyan yoga, dhyan yoga, and bhakti yoga. And karma yoga is somewhat mechanical. You know, I do my work, I do my pious work, but I dedicate it to salvation rather than to my own sense gratification. Gyan yoga, I become detached. I am not these thoughts. I am not these feelings. I let these thoughts and feelings flow through me. I am separate. I am the observer. This has become very popular today, yeah? Yeah, gyan yoga is. Unfortunately, gyan yoga has become popular under Buddhism or Buddhist-related ideas. But gyan yoga is very popular. Or dhyan yoga, where, you know, I just meditate, I put my body into a state of trance, right? I raise the life air through the different chakras, through different breathing and postures, and I go into a state of calm, and in this state I can see myself. This is also very popular at the modern time. Again, unfortunately, very Buddhist influenced. So all of those are more or less mechanical, and therefore they cannot work without a touch of bhakti. Why? First of all, as Prabhupada's saying here, most people can't do them very well. And we might think, well, I can do it very well, but most people can't. There are a few. I mean, there are some people who can attain like Brahman realization through Gyan Yoga and Astanga Yoga. There are some people, or through Karma Yoga. But it's definitely in the minority. Most people, what is it? Unfortunate, always disturbed. Are most people unfortunate? I mean, if people just come from, you know, if they're raised by their natural parents in a loving home, that's become an exception today. Am I correct?
Yes.
If you say, you know, I was raised by my natural parents and they're still together, you know, they're together for 70 years and the home was loving, there was no abuse going on and nobody ever abused me, you're kind of like a freak. I mean, it was funny, there was that Me Too movement, and I'm thinking, I never got sexually abused, I guess I'm a weirdo, you know. People are unfortunate. And people are walking around with so many traumas. Correct? And, right? They're unfortunate. It's hard for people to have enough money to live. It's hard for people to find honest work that's of their nature. And if you find honest work that's of your nature, then you've got a work environment that's not conducive. There's, we were talking yesterday in Career Dharma, how there's just cheating throughout the society. And then it's hard to live in a nice place. Most people are living in cities where there's so much pollution, where you can't eat healthy food, you can't drink healthy water. You know, you're lucky if you have to go to a special place to see trees and birds and flowers. People are unfortunate. And then their minds are constantly disturbed. So they can't follow these things perfectly anyway. But the ultimate reason is that perfection isn't mechanical. Perfection is personal. Ultimate perfection, I was just hearing Prabhupada say this morning, which he says over and over again, is to know God and to know your relationship with God. That's perfection. Perfection isn't just that you're in some state of neutrality where you don't feel the material miseries and you're just like lying on top of the ocean in a state of peace. That's not what we ultimately want. I mean, that might be nice after a, you know, hard day, a really hard day at work or something. But it's not what we ultimately want. I, as a teenager, I was with a group that took a bicycle tour through Jasper Banff National Park in the Rockies in Canada, and in Lake Louise, which is gorgeous, by the way. So I took a canoe out to the island in the middle of Lake Louise, and I was sitting there meditating, and I just thought, I could just stay here forever. Just with, I mean, that was pure water, pure air, just the forest. And after about a half an hour, I thought, you know, I actually couldn't stay here forever. I'd like to see other people sometimes. I'd like to have more than one set of clothes. You know, I just don't think I was 16. I thought, I really don't think I could just stay here forever. And Prabhupada talks about, right, that those avasuddha buddhiya, those who attain Brahman realization, they fall down again. Because it's not personal. And I've actually read accounts of people, contemporary people, who attained Brahman realization and said, I don't want to stay there. I'd rather have illusion of being a separate person so I can have a relationship. Because that's not what perfection is. What we ultimately want is love. What we ultimately want is connection. We don't just want peace. Yes, we want peace, but we don't just want peace. We don't just want freedom from misery. You know, if you're really sick and you get well, You don't want to just be well. You want to do the kind of things that healthy people do. I'm well. Okay, now what? This happens with people who've been in prison, especially if they've been in prison for a long time. And they get out and they're like, well, now what do I do as a free person? So that's perfection, and because it's about personal relationships, without establishing a personal relationship as part of the process, we're not getting what we want. We're not going to be satisfied. Also, if we think about it in a very personal way, and I give this kind of example all the time, you know, we're conditioned souls because we're turning our back, as Mahaprabhu says, Bahir Mukhe, we're turning our face from Krishna. We're trying to be independent from Krishna. We're not even acknowledging his presence, what to speak of being grateful and loving. Now, in any of our human relationships, probably most of us have had someone who betrayed us in that way. Someone we did things for, and they weren't grateful, and they turned on us in some way. Yes, has everyone had that kind of a relationship? That sort of a situation? Someone you thought, oh, this is my friend, I like this person, or a family member, and you do a lot for them, and you're there for them, and they don't appreciate it, and they even turn away from you. They may even criticize you. They may even criticize you to other people. And then if they come, they say, I want the relationship back. So at first you might be happy. You might say, oh, that's really nice. I've missed our relationship. I valued our relationship. But then you're going to ask them to do something to indicate that you can trust them again. But that doing something is not going to be merely mechanical. Like in a marriage, you know, if the husband's cheated on his wife with, you know, 20 women, and then he comes back and he says, I'm sorry, I want the relationship back. So she might say, well, that's very nice. But now this is what you need to do. So if he does those things and he comes to her and he says, okay, you know, I did this, now you have to take me back. She's going to say, no, you've lost the whole point. You follow what I'm saying? You know, you're just going to, like, get her a diamond bracelet and get her flowers and take that texting app off your phone or something, you know. But the point is that the person has to develop actual humility. And really say, I understand how I've hurt you. I understand how I violated trust. I understand how I betrayed you. And I don't want to do that ever again. So the different religious rituals are meant to do several things. They're meant to develop, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 12:9, they're meant to awaken in us a desire to have that relationship with Krishna. Do you know that if you serve someone, you tend to become attached to them? It's just how it works in the world. So they're meant to awaken that desire. Oh, I want to have my relationship with Krishna. They're also meant, Chaito Darpana Marjanam, to clean the dust from our consciousness so that we see ourselves accurately. And we see, hey, this break in my relationship with Krishna is completely my responsibility. Which is really awful because that means I'm completely responsible for all the suffering I'm going through. And it's completely wonderful because that means I have the agency to restore it. And these different religious rituals are also to show Krishna that we're serious, that it's not just, you know, talk. Anybody can say, I love you, I love you, I love you. I care about you. But what are you going to do? You have to do something to show that. You know, I had a friend who said, Urmila, I'll always be there for you. And one time I had a doctor's appointment in an hour and my car died and I called her up and I said, can you drive me to the doctor? She said, you know, it's my day off. I really don't want to go anywhere. Okay. So, you know, just to say I love you, I love you. So it's to develop and awaken love. It's to purify us, and it's also to demonstrate to Krishna that we're serious. It's not just, you know, lip service, as we say. That's cheap. That's sahajiyas. Sahajiyas are all, you know, I love Krishna, but I'm not going to follow any austerity. I'm not going to follow any rules. I'm not going to actually do anything to demonstrate that love. So therefore, they're important, and therefore Prabhupada says they're definitely helpful. What does he say? He says they're undoubtedly helpful. Without any doubt, they're helpful. But the real thing is humility. That's the real thing. And getting that mercy of a devotee, where Krishna's mercy will flow through the devotee. That's the real thing. So here we talk about putting your head at the feet of a devotee, bathing yourself in the dust. They're literal. One should literally put one's head at the feet of a devotee. One should literally take the dust from a devotee's feet on one's head. That is literal. But those are also metaphors, simultaneously. To put your head at someone's feet is a sign of humility. It's a sign of submission. And it's a very extreme sign of submission. Of the six principles of surrender, one of them is humility. Our main problem is that we have a pride that I can be happy independently of Krishna. That's kind of the essence of the problem. Which, from a logical point of view, is an absurdity. We're so ridiculously small and so ridiculously helpless that the concept that we can be a controller of the world, I mean, it's ridiculous. I can't even control whether or not I get a fever today. I can't control that. I can't control whether some crazy driver rams into me and paralyzes me. I can't control that. I can't control how other people think and feel. People come to me all the time asking me to, you know, fix their husband or fix their child. Sometimes they ask me to fix their guru. Seriously. I wish I was joking about that one. But, you know, I can't control other people. I can hardly control my own mind. I can hardly control my own senses and my own mind. I can't control what happens in my life. I'm so tiny. Krishna says he is the ability in man. If Krishna doesn't want me to raise my arm, I won't be able to do it anymore. It doesn't matter. You know, I can desire it and desire it, but if he paralyzes my arm, I can't do anything. Krishna is my intelligence. Krishna is our intelligence. He's our wisdom. He's our ability. He's joining with our life breath. He's digesting our food stuff. I can't even control whether or not I digest what I eat. Can any of you perfectly control whether or not you digest what you eat? So it's ridiculous pride that I'm going to be happy without Krishna. I'm going to be a controller without Krishna. I don't need God. But although it's absurd, we have to emotionally come to that point. I'm actually in need and have this gratitude. We have to be able to realize that I'm making a mistake. That's what has to happen. And all of the rituals, all of the procedures, all of the rules and regulations are just to bring us to that. That's the whole essence of the thing. And if you can do that from the first second, you've already achieved everything. Like Prabhupada often quotes, what's the use of all your austerities if you don't come to surrender to Krishna? And if you surrender to Krishna, what's the need for any austerities? That is the austerity. The austerity is, oh, I've been really dumb. I'm trying to do something impossible and unnatural, and all I'm doing is hurting myself. That's the actual austerity. And we get that by the grace of the devotee. Why? Because the devotee's doing it, and we see, oh, look at that. Srila Prabhupada's humble, Srila Prabhupada's surrendered, Srila Prabhupada's not trying to be an independent controller, and look how happy he is. And look how empowered he is. Oh, maybe that's what I should do. We get that inspiration, we get that example, and as we said yesterday, we get the instruction. How can I become like you? And we get the mercy, we get the grace, we get the pleasure of the pure devotees. And Krishna says, oh, you please my devotee? Okay. I'll accept you. Right? I had years ago this one devotee who I'd never met her. I never had anything to do with her, and somehow she decided that she really didn't like me. And she was writing emails to a lot of people complaining about me. She was complaining that I gave a class in Mayapur during the GBC meetings. That I was the first woman to do that. And so she was she was really complaining. And it was becoming really uncomfortable. When I was at a temple where she was, I would like walk around so I wouldn't have to see her. And I said, why is she hating me so much? Then I found out that we had a mutual friend. That one of my very dear friends was also friends with her. And so I thought, if someone who you respect so much also really likes this person, there must be something worthy about them. And so I started dealing with her with that in mind. I started just tolerating all of her criticism of me and just finding some way to be appreciative of her. And after about 6 months, we became friends. We never became like close friends, but we became friends. Why? Because someone who I loved and respected loved and respected her. So Krishna is also like that. If one of his pure devotees says, hey, you know that little universe with the four-headed Brahma, you know, the tiny universe, and then there's in that galaxy, you know, in the Milky Way galaxy, and then that solar system, that Earth planet, you know, the place you go to do your leelas, well, there's this little Urmila there right now. Would you accept her? And he's like, sure. That's just how it works. And without that, my dear friends, it's not working. Prabhupada says we'll have no access. Now, this is a sort of a side note, but it's an important one, and I don't have time to get into it in depth, but just to mention it, this is why if we commit some offense against devotees, you can't just say, well, there's no prayaschitta in bhakti except the holy name, I'm just going to sit and chant. Doesn't work. You can go on chanting for millions and billions of lifetimes and it doesn't work. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakura says when we offend a devotee, we have to try to rectify with that devotee. If they won't accept our apology, then we have to serve that devotee for a very long time. And if that devotee still doesn't accept us, then we can just chant constantly. But you can't just jump to, I'm going to just chant constantly. I know of a case of a devotee who committed a very grievous offense, like a 9.5 out of 10 offense against another devotee. And this person, the offender is thinking, well, I'm just going to sit and chant all day. I said, that's not going to work. I said, you have to do something to try to please that devotee that you offended. It's not mechanical. We're not going to force Krishna. I chant my 16 rounds every day, and I chant my three Gayatris, and I go to Mangal Arati, and I follow the regular principles, and I wave lots of sticks of incense, and where's my prema? You know, he's going to say, hey, you kind of lost the whole point of the whole thing. It's not how one develops relationships. Yes. And Prabhupada ends by saying, how do we know who's the devotee of whom we should take shelter? Someone who's already done that with someone else. Satsukh Maharaj once said that he was distributing books at the airport and he met one man who says, well, I don't need to join your organization. I already have a master. He said, oh, who's your master? Oh, so-and-so. Oh, who's his master? Oh, I don't know. I don't even know if he has a master. And Satsukh Maharaj was saying, if you say, I'm a master without a master, you're saying I'm God. So therefore we look to the parampara. Who's following? A devotee is someone who's following a devotee, who's following a devotee. And Prabhupada's asking us to become Mahatmas. One time a devotee wrote a letter to Prabhupada and signed it, your eternally useless servant. So We shouldn't be eternally useless. We're also supposed to become empowered by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We're supposed to become also a touchstone who can be a conduit for the mercy of the Lord. So this is how we have access. On the one hand, it's very easy. It's not a complicated thing. Take shelter of the feet of a great devotee in humility, follow their instructions, and give up one's false prestige, give up one's false ego. In practice, it's extremely difficult because we're so attached to this completely ridiculous, illogical illusion. Right? Like Prabhupada told Tamal Krishnamurti. Right? There's this whole universe, there's a whole solar system, there's the whole planet. There's this big city of Los Angeles, and here there's this one tiny jiva who thinks that he's the big important person. But giving that up, and by the way, when we give that up, we feel so relieved that we don't have to pretend that we're some big, important, consequential being anymore. It's such a burden to carry around. I'm important. I'm significant. I'm the controller. When it's a lie, it's a big burden to walk around with a lie all the time. And letting go of that, you're like, wow, I can just be an insignificant servant of the Lord. And what's ironic, of course, like Jesus said, those who seek to gain their life will lose it. Those who lose their life for myself will gain it. The irony is when one develops this deep humility, then one realizes that one is also infinitely important because one is infinitely loved. And just like I was giving class in Brazil, and there was a mother with her little baby, 3-4 week old baby, and my whole class, she was just counting her baby's toes. The whole class, she's standing back just counting her baby's toes. The baby is just one jiva among billions in the world. But to the mother, the baby was everything. So even though we're one of uncountable jivas, to Krishna, each of us is everything. And we discover that we're infinitely valuable and infinitely worthy when we accept that we're infinitely insignificant. Isn't that interesting? Yes. And therefore, Swayambhuva Manu is saying, Disya, I'm fortunate. Because part of humility is joyful gratitude. Although I am so tiny, I'm a speck on a speck on a speck on a speck. The whole universe is a speck on the head of Ananta. The whole universe, the planet, is a speck. Los Angeles, sorry folks, is a speck. And in LA, I'm a speck. And I'm so tiny. And I'm so powerless. And I'm so helpless. And I'm so insignificant. But Disya, I'm so fortunate. How wonderful that I can get this mercy of the devotees, that I can get this mercy of the Lord. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements. Yes?
How do you practice humility in wonderful aspects? How do you practice humility in chanting since your mind is jumping and you just say, okay?
Well, first of all, the fact that your mind is jumping ought to make you humble. Like Prabhupada says, you know, it's very difficult for common people to perform these austerities, so then it can remind us that, well, I'm a common people too. Because sometimes we'll read this, you know, oh, these common people, the common man is unable to control his senses. And we might think, well, Prabhupada's talking about the Walmart shoppers. He's not talking about me, I'm not a common man. Right? At least when I read this, that's where my mind immediately goes. Oh yes, those common men. They can't control their mind and their senses. When I first moved in the temple, I remember sitting in the classes and the devotees were talking about how foolish the materialists were, and I would always think, yeah, those foolish materialists. Did any of you have this kind of experience? Then after a couple months, I was like, oops. I'm one of them. Then I need grace. I need grace. I really like Bhagavad Gita 2:64. Krishna says, if you give up attachment and aversion and you regulate the senses, you'll get Bhagavat prasadam. If we make an effort, wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature, to constantly withdraw it and fix it on the self. And we're making an effort. And we're asking for mercy. Hey, I'm just a common man. I'm trying to control my mind and my senses. I'm genuinely trying. And I just keep failing. Help. But if one thinks, and you know, I hear devotees say this, well, if you just sit still, you don't move a muscle for your full 16 rounds. They're giving all these mechanical things. Somehow you'll force Krishna to appear. I don't think that works. And then whenever you have some little, I mean, Krishna says to Uddhava that chanting the holy name is like making a fire by rubbing wood together. And at first it's just hard work and you just get a lot of smoke. And then you get some heat. The heat is when the mind becomes also absorbed in the chanting, and then you get a little spark. The spark is when the intelligence becomes absorbed in the chanting. And then when you get that spark, right? We get sparks sometimes in the kirtan and in japa. We get a little spark. And then he says, porgy. Don't just watch the spark come and go. Oh, there's a spark. Look at that. Or Prabhupada will say, fan it. Grab it. Go deep into it. And eventually that will awaken the desire of the soul. Is that all right? I could say more, but it's getting late. We'll take one more and then we'll need to end. Yes, Prabhu. No, you. You had your hand raised. Oh, you want the mic? For all of the internet folks.
Thank you. At one point you were mentioning about, you were giving the example of the devotee who committed a lot of offenses.
Yeah, yeah.
He just decided, I'm going to chant.
Yeah.
So what would happen in the case of some, you know, devotees who sometimes for many different reasons, they lead the group, the society of this particular devotee with this particular pure devotee, and they go to another pure devotee. But they never probably have the chance to come back and ask for forgiveness. And they still...
That's above my pay grade, Prabhu. Like, seriously. That's something for those gurus and Krishna to work out with that jiva. Many years ago, I decided that I was no longer going to get involved in any way, shape, or form with trying to evaluate or judge situations like that. Like, at all. Let them work it out. Let these great devotees, they can have a meeting and work it out. I mean, I'm really serious. That's between Krishna and the jiva, and between the personalities and the jiva. It's not for me to say. And I've come to this conclusion by seeing individuals in different circumstances, and like you were saying to me, that these things are very individual. And if you want to make some blanket thing and put everybody in the same pot, so that's not going to work. You know, when is that offensive? When is it not offensive? That really depends on the person. It's, you know, to judge everyone in that circumstance as an offender, that's an offense. But one has to be very, very careful. Yeah, for myself personally, I want to just kind of hold on tight to Srila Prabhupada's lotus feet. That's for me. I feel very safe there. acceptance. That's a different realm. Yeah. Sorry. That's a very different realm from someone who beats someone or rapes someone or something like that and can't just sit and then chant. You know, if I'm going to beat up a devotee or rape a devotee, then I'm not just going to Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You know, I have to actually do something to counter that. Is that all right? Thank you very much for your hospitality, for keeping this wonderful center going for Srila Prabhupada at such a high standard. It's lovely to see Rukmini Dwarkadish covered in so many flowers on this Ekadasi. It was just really appreciating. Thank you. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.